Hey guys, welcome back to That Canadian Podcast. I'm your host, and that Canadian, Sam. As you can already tell by the title of this episode, we are talking about the Zodiac Killer today, and all of his murders, and all of his letters, and all of his tauntings, all of it. We're talking about everything from start to finish, pretty much. There's a lot that he did that I'm not going to be able to cover in one episode, but I'm going to give you a fairly detailed summary of what happened and what went down. Now, if you've been listening to the podcast for a while, you'd know that I struggle with pronouncing names. So there's some names in this podcast, or names of locations in this episode, I should say, that I struggle with, and I'm just going to go ahead and apologize ahead of time. Now, if you're new here, first of all, hi, hello, welcome. Second of all, this is something that you're just going to get used to the more that you listen, because it's a problem. I can't fix it. I don't know why. It is what it is. Anyway, so there's a lot of info to get through today. And to be honest with you, I don't want it to run too long and have to edit like 3 hours worth of audio. So let's just jump into it. Everything started in early June of 1963. I don't have an exact date, but all we know, or all I know and was able to find, is that everything started in early June. So in early June, it was Senior Ditch Day at the Santa Barbara County High School in Southern California. Two seniors that attended that high school were named Robert Domingos and his fiancée, Linda Edwards. The young couple decided to go sunbathing at a beach near Gavota State Park. I think that's how to say it. Anyways, so Robert didn't end up coming home that night, so his dad went to investigate into what was going on. Why wasn't his son home? So anyway, Robert's dad goes to the beach to look and see if maybe Robert and Linda were still there. Maybe they just camped out overnight. He was just hoping to find him. And unfortunately, he did, but not the way he wanted to find him. Once he got there on the Wednesday morning, he found Robert and Linda tied up with rope lying inside of the remains of a, I guess it was like an old shack, like a shack that was falling apart. Now, evidence indicates that they tried to escape, but obviously they couldn't. Evidence also showed that they were killed with a .22 caliber weapon. Now, Robert was shot 11 times, and Linda had been shot 9 times. And once they were killed, the killer dragged them to this shack, this falling apart cabin, shack, whatever it was, and attempted to start a fire. I guess it wouldn't work, it didn't happen, so I guess he just abandoned it and left it, hoping that nobody would find them. The investigators initially had like a few suspects, but they weren't able to definitively determine who it was at that time. Now, later in 1972, the Santa Barbara County Sheriff's Department actually announced that it was a possible connection to the Zodiac killings. And they were able to do that because the killer in this case used the same ammunition used by the Zodiac during the 1968 murders on Lake Herman Road. There was also some similarities between the Domingos and Edwards case and the attack of Brian Hartnell and Cecilia Shepherd that were murdered in the Lake Berryessa area in 1969. On October 30th, 1966, Sherry Josephine Bates, she was 18 years old and was a student at the Riverside City College. She ended up leaving a note for her dad that day saying, "Dad, went to RCC Library." I guess RCC stood for Riverside City College, obviously. Anyway. Just like Robert and Linda, she didn't return home that night. The next morning, her Volkswagen Beetle had been found in the parking lot by the library. It was completely abandoned. Her body was lying close to it between two houses. And upon investigation, it was found that she was stabbed several times and her throat was slashed. Now, at the scene, police were able to find a men's Timex watch, a print from a military boot, and some hairs in dried blood on Sherry's hand. They were able to determine it wasn't a robbery just because her purse was intact, nothing was missing from her purse, money, keys, whatever. Everything was there, so that led them to believe that it was not a robbery gone wrong. About a month after the murder, the local newspaper and the police department received a typed letter called The Confession from someone who claimed to be her killer. The killer wrote things saying that she was stupid, that she went to slaughter like a lamb, and he added that at some point in the letter he added that he wasn't sick, he was just insane. In April 1967, the newspaper, the police, and Joseph Bates, Sherry's dad, received the exact same handwritten letters that all said that she had to die and that there would be more. Now, I guess the writing was kind of messy. So police determined that it was signed with the letter Z, or they think that it was signed with the letter Z. On December 20th, 1968, David Faraday, who was 17, and Betty Lou Jensen, who was 16, were on their first date. Apparently, they went to different schools, but they were finally going on this date that they had been looking forward to for a while. Even though they'd only known each other for a couple of weeks, I guess it was love at first sight. When David picked up Betty Lou, he met her parents and told them that he wouldn't bring her home too late. I think he said sometime like around 10:30-ish. At the end of the night, after their date is mostly over, they went to a specific spot on Lake Herman Road in Benicia. Oh my gosh, guys, I'm so sorry. Anyway, they went to this spot on Lake Herman Road, which is often referred to as a lover's lane to the local people, the local teenagers. I don't know what they were doing there, but at some point, from what investigators could tell, someone pulled up beside their car, got out, and began rapidly firing at them. David was shot once, and when the firing started, Betty Lou got out of the car and tried to run away. Now, her body was found approximately 25 to 30 feet from the car, and she was shot 5 times in the back and died almost instantly. The ammo used was, again, a .22 caliber, which was most likely from a semi-automatic gun. Someone just so happened to be driving by and saw their bodies close to the car, and they immediately went to the next house, and they immediately alerted the authorities. Now, I'm not quite sure how they did it, if they saw the bodies, drove to the next house, told them, went back, or if they checked to see if they were alive. I don't know how it worked. They didn't have cell phones then. I was alive when there was no cell phones, but I never came across a situation like this, so I don't know how it was handled. When the paramedics and authorities arrived on scene, David was still alive, but unfortunately he didn't even make it to the hospital before he passed away. When the police were examining the scene, the investigators determined that the killer may have fired some warning shots just to get them out of the car based on where the bullet holes were in the car and in the back window. Initially, police suspected Betty Lou's ex-boyfriend did it, but once they did an interview with him, they found out that he was at home watching a movie with his family that night. They also found out that there was 2 people hunting in the area that night. They questioned them, and the ammo that the 2 hunters were carrying with them did not match the ammo used by the gunman in the murder, so they were cleared. And this ultimately led the investigators to believe that this was a random killing, that there was no rhyme or reason behind it, that it was a spontaneous kill, and it was a murder of opportunity kind of thing. On July 4th, 1969, Michael Magoo, who was 19, and Darlene Farron, who was 22, were parked at a similar type of lover's lane in Blue Rock Springs Park that was located in Vallejo. What happened this time is that the killer got out of the car, flashed the light at them, which led them to believe that he was a cop, and because they thought he was a police officer, they started to get out their IDs. They quickly realized that he was not a police officer because the second he got to the driver's side door, he started shooting. Now, once the killer started firing, he hit Michael in the jaw. Then, because he was shot, Michael tried to get himself up and push himself back into the back seat to try and get out of the line of fire. And in doing so, The killer also shot him in, I believe, the knee because of how he was getting back in. Now, I say I believe because of the information that's coming up next. And because he pushed himself back, the remainder of the bullets ended up going into Darlene. Now, she was shot several times, and when the killer thought that she was dead and that Michael was dead, he walked away. But at some point, before the killer could get to his car, he heard Michael moaning because he was in pain. He had just been shot in the knee, I think, and the jaw. So he goes back. Now, this time when the killer goes back, he didn't bother obscuring his face by flashing the light directly in Michael's face because he thought, oh, well, this guy's gonna die. There's no point in trying to hide my face. So he goes up to him and shoots him again. And I believe that's when he shot him in like the shoulder, neck area, somewhere in there. Now, what's interesting and different about this murder is that at 12:40 p.m., the killer called the police station from a payphone that was actually a couple of blocks away. And when he called, all he said was,
"I wish to report a double murder. If one of you will go a mile east on Columbus Parkway, you will find the kids in a brown car. They have been shot by a 9mm Luger. I also killed those kids last year. Goodbye."
Now, I'm sorry if I said Luger wrong. It's Luger, Lugger. Guys, come on. It's me. I'm sorry. It happened. It is what it is. Despite having received this phone call at 12:40, police were already on scene because they had received a report from a couple of teenagers a few minutes after the shooting took place. Because police were able to respond so quickly, they were able to save Michael's life, and unfortunately, Darlene passed away at the scene. And because Michael survived, he was able to give a pretty good description of what the killer looked like. And that's all because the killer, like I said before, didn't hold up a flashlight that second time, because he wasn't expecting Michael to survive. Less than a month later, on July 31st, 1969, a letter was sent to the Vallejo Times-Herald, the San Francisco Examiner, and the San Francisco Chronicle, each with the same letter but different sections of a cipher. In the letter, he demanded that it be placed on the front page, and if not, he'd go on a killing rampage. He also claimed responsibility for the two shootings that had just taken place. Now, this letter isn't very long. There are some longer letters that he wrote, but this one, since it's not very long, I will read it to you. But all the links will be available on the website in the sources section. He wrote, "Dear Editor, I'm the killer of the two teenagers last Christmas at Lake Herman and the girl last 4th of July. To prove this, I shall state some facts which only I and the police know. Christmas. Brand name of ammo, Super X. 10 shots fired. Boy was on his back with feet to car. Girl was lying on right side, feet to west. July 4th. Girl was wearing pattern pants. Boy was also shot in knee. Ammo was made by Western. Here is a cipher, or that is part one of three. The other two parts are being mailed to the Vallejo Times and San Francisco Chronicle. I want you to print this cipher on the front page by Friday afternoon, August 1st, 69. If you do not print this cipher, I will go on a kill rampage Friday night. This will last the whole weekend. I will cruise around killing people who are alone at night until Sunday night, or until I kill a dozen people." Now, one thing I want to mention is that in all of the letters that he wrote, there are many spelling mistakes, many grammatical mistakes. And what I find interesting is that there are so many mistakes, and yet his ciphers are so difficult to decipher. So I'm wondering if maybe these mistakes are on purpose. Maybe there's a message in the mistakes. I mean, I'm not a professional by any means. I hardly know anything about ciphers. And what I do know is only because I've deciphered some in the Hunt a Killer boxes, which, by the way, if you go to huntakiller.com and use the code WEATHERS, you'll get 20% off your purchase of your first box. Just saying, you can go there and use that code. Do it now. Anyway, I think there's a possibility of a code in the misspellings and the grammatical errors, but who am I to say? Anyway, moving on. After about a week of the public having access to these ciphers, two amateur cryptologists, I think they're called, were able to decipher it after, I think they said 20 hours or something like that. Now, each one, I should say, well, that he actually said himself, they were, it was one cipher divided up into three sent to different newspapers. So some of them are incomplete. For example, the one that ends, the one for Vallejo Times ends with GI instead of gives. So it was kind of incomplete, which would have made it more difficult to decipher. So the cipher actually said, "I like killing people because it's so much fun. It's more fun than killing wild game in the forest because man is the most dangerous animal of all." To kill something, and that's pretty much where the letter ended, and the next cipher that was sent to the San Francisco Examiner started with V-E-S. So let's just say it starts with gives. "Gives me the most thrilling experience. It's even better than getting your rocks off with a girl. The best part of it is that when I die, I will be reborn into paradise with all the..." And then the San Francisco Chronicle's copy of the cipher said, "Lone or stray people I have killed will become my slaves. I will not give you my name because you will try to slow down or stop my collecting of slaves for my afterlife." When the San Francisco Chronicle ran the story and the cipher, they didn't listen to his demands. They did not run it on the first page. Instead, they put it on the fourth page. The two people that I had said deciphered it were named Donald and Betty Hardin. They were able to decipher it because they actually profiled him, and they assumed that because of his arrogance and his need for attention, that he would start the letter with an I. So from there, they were just able to look for duplicate letters and so on and so forth. I'm not even going to begin to try to explain it because, like I said earlier, I am not an expert. So if you want to know more, you can read it from the sources on my website. And this cipher was eventually named the Z408 cipher, and they called it the 408 cipher because it had 408 characters. Vallejo Police Chief Jack E. Stilt still wasn't convinced that he was the killer, so on August 3rd, he had the Chronicle publish an article asking the killer for more information, and the killer happily obliged. Despite threatening to go on a killing spree if they didn't post the story on the front page of the paper, the Zodiac didn't actually go on a killing spree like he said he would, although he did follow up with the police chief's request for more information. He sent in another letter, and this is the first letter where he referred to himself as the Zodiac. Now, this letter is a little long, not as long as his longest, but it is a little long. I'll read through it quickly. But I will have a link to the whole letter on the website in the sources section. But the highlights of this letter are basically, he started out with saying, "Dear editor, this is the Zodiac speaking," which is the first time, like I said, that he referred to himself as the Zodiac. He went on to say that on the 4th of July, he didn't open the car door, that the window was already rolled down, and then he killed the boy, explained how he killed the boy. He described the murder and what happened, obviously providing more information that the police wanted. And he said that when he made the phone call to the police station, there was a man, but he actually said a little racist slur, which you'll be able to read in the actual note, who was about 40 or 45 years old. And he said that, when he disconnected the call with the police department, they called back, and the ringing of the payphone is actually what brought this man's attention to the Zodiac. And he then went on to explain the murders from the the December 20th shootings. He called it an episode. He didn't call it shootings, murders, whatever. He called it an episode, which I find intriguing. And because he has this need for attention, it's almost like he's creating a TV show for himself, and each murder is an episode. And when he ended the letter, he didn't sign his name. Instead, he drew a symbol, which is the crosshairs. And that actually became his logo, like his not his calling card, but for lack of a better word, logo. And because this letter had so much information detailing each murder, information that no one else could possibly know except for police and the killer, The police chief was able to determine that he actually was the killer and they were actually communicating with the person who did the killing, not someone who was trying to take credit for something they didn't do. The next murder took place on September 27th, 1969. A young Brian Hartnell and Cecilia Shepherd were having a picnic at Lake Berryessa. They were brutally stabbed multiple times. Unfortunately, Cecilia passed away on the scene and Hartnell survived. Now, many people look into this and say that the Zodiac must have an issue with women, and it probably stems back to how he was raised when he was a kid, because more often than not, they survive the killing. The women get the brunt of the aggression and you know, shootings or stabbings, whereas the men only get shot a couple of times or stabbed just a few times, way less than the women do. Whether that's true or not, I'm not sure, but that's an interesting take on why his victims were killed in the manner that they were. Even though Brian Hartnell was stabbed several times, he survived. And because he survived, he was able to tell the police what happened in a very detailed interview. I found this interview to be very impressive. There was a documentary called This is the Zodiac Speaking, and it's on YouTube, and it's so good. It's got this interview, this exact interview with Brian Hartnell. It's about 45 minutes in, maybe. I think it's actually like 44 minutes, 30 seconds or something like that into the documentary. And he goes into detail about the conversations that he had with the Zodiac. He initially described the Zodiac before he goes into the conversation. He said that the Zodiac was wearing a black hood with holes cut out for his eyes, and that on the hood, in the chest area, there was the crosshair symbol. And he said it didn't look like it was just put on quickly. It looked like he put effort into putting that symbol on his chest, that it wasn't messy. It was very neat, very neat. And because it's such a good interview, I'm going to link to the movie itself in the sources section on the website. You should definitely watch it. I was looking for the interview, like a clip of the interview itself, so I could include the audio in the podcast episode, but I couldn't find it and I can't take from the movie. I have no idea how to reach out to producers or anything like that, so you're just going to have to go watch the documentary yourself. But it's free, so yay. Anyway, so this interview that he was giving was very interesting. He said that he was talking with the guy, trying to find out whatever he could about him to try and create a relationship, so to speak, with this killer. And he asked him who he was, what he was doing, and the Zodiac actually told him that he was an inmate that had just escaped from prison, and all he wanted was their car and their money. And Brian actually said, "Well, I'm really sorry, but I've only got 75 cents in my pocket, but you're welcome to take my car. Is there anything else I can do to help you?" He actually tried to create this really good rapport with the killer, so that way he would seem more like a human, maybe even be less likely to be killed. And I think that he didn't actually even expect to be killed. And I say this because as he was going through the story of the conversation he had, he said that eventually the killer brought out pre-cut plastic clothesline rope, I guess is what I'll call it. Pre-cut plastic clothesline rope. And he tied them up, hog-tied them. And Brian had heard that in his class that when somebody is robbing somebody else using a gun, 9 times out of 10, the gun isn't loaded because should something go wrong, the robber doesn't want to shoot someone, kill them, and have manslaughter added to their sentence. So the gun is just used for a scare tactic, even though it's not actually loaded. So he thought he's going to ask him. So he says, "Hey," I don't know if he said, "Hey," I wasn't there. He didn't say, but he asked him if the gun was even loaded as the killer started to walk away. The killer stops, turns around, comes back, and ejects the mag from the gun and shows him that it's full. And I don't remember what Brian said, but almost right after that, he took out a knife and started stabbing them. Even if you don't want to watch the whole documentary, I highly recommend going to watch just that interview alone. It's Very well done. Not well done. It's very interesting, very informative. That's what I'm trying to say. Zodiac ended up stabbing Brian 6 times and Cecilia 10 times, and he ended up writing a message on the door of Brian's car, and it said Vallejo, 12-20-68, 7-4-69, September 27, 69, 6:30 p.m. At 7:40 p.m., he called the Napa Police Department and said,
I want to report a murder. No. A double murder. They are 2 miles north of park headquarters. They were in a white Volkswagen Karmann Ghia. I'm the one who did it.
And he hung up the phone. Police were able to trace the call to a payphone, again a few blocks away from the police department. Initially, Cecilia survived, but after a couple of days in the hospital, she succumbed to her injuries. On October 11th, 1969, the last known Zodiac killing occurred, and it was a very odd murder. And I say odd because there was a man who hailed a cab, and the person who drove that cab was Paul Stein. The man who hailed the cab asked to be taken to a park nearby, and when they arrived at the park, he shot and killed the driver. Before he left, Zodiac took Paul's wallet and keys and cut off a piece of his shirt that was soaked in blood. The police arrived just moments after the man walked away, and there were several witnesses who were able to give a very brief description of what the man looked like, which somewhat matched the description of the Zodiac. Now, when they were at the crime scene, there wasn't a lot of evidence they were able to gather, but they were able to find a couple of partial prints on the door, and it showed that on, I believe it was the index finger, there was a scar. Anyway. They were able to find these fingerprints, which is the first time they were able to find anything like that. At first, people doubted that this was actually the Zodiac's doing because it was so different from the other killings that the Zodiac claims to have done. But the witness descriptions match the descriptions given by previous victims of the Zodiac killer. And not only that, but another letter was received at the San Francisco Chronicle by the Zodiac claiming responsibility for the murder, and it also had a piece of Paul's shirt. The letter said, This is the Zodiac speaking. I'm the murderer of the taxi driver over by Washington Street and Maple Street. To prove this, here is a bloodstained piece of his shirt. I'm the same man who did the people in the North Bay area. The San Francisco police could have caught me last night if they had searched the park properly instead of holding road races with their motorcycles, seeing who could make the most noise. The car drivers should have just parked their cars and sat there quietly, waiting for me to come out of cover. School children make nice targets. I think I shall wipe out a school bus one morning, just shoot the front tire and pick off the little kitties as they come bouncing out. He signed the letter with the Zodiac symbol, and the Chronicle ran the story. Once the story was published, as you can imagine, fear and panic spread through San Francisco. Parents were worried about putting their children on buses, and people were debating even taking their kids to school in the first place. Now, in Zodiac fashion, he didn't follow up with these threats. He never ended up taking out a school bus. He never ended up killing any children, which, thank God, because that would have just been awful. On October 22, 1969, someone claiming to be the Zodiac called the Oakland Police Department, and he made a bunch of demands, saying that he wanted to talk to Melvin Belli on a local talk show. Melvin Belli was a big shot lawyer, and pretty sure he was one of the best lawyers in the country at that time. Anyways, Melvin ended up accepting the invitation to speak with him on the talk show. And obviously, the Zodiac didn't show up. He called in. And when he did call, he would only talk for a couple of minutes at a time, tops. Then he would hang up and call back, hang up and call back. And apparently, he ended up doing this around 54, 55 times, something like that. Nobody heard from the Zodiac until November 9th, 1969. And that's when the Chronicle received another letter and another piece of Paul Stein's shirt. They also received another cipher, which is now called the Z340 cipher. This is known to be his most difficult cipher to date. Actually, I'm fairly certain it was the last cipher that he sent. Anyways, Experts believe that the Zodiac made this cipher so difficult because he wanted to assert his dominance over the San Francisco Police Department and prove that he is still smarter than they are. In the letter, he had written December, July, August, September, October, equals 7, which hints at more potential victims that he could have possibly killed. In his letter, he asked for the Chronicle to print the cipher on the front page, and he actually wrote, "I get awfully lonely when I'm ignored. So lonely I could do my thing." And then he wrote, December, July, August, September, October, equals 7. There is more to this Z340 cipher, but we're going to talk about that towards the end of the episode. And if you've been reading the news lately, you already know what I'm going to say, but bear with me here. We're almost done. Shortly after sending that letter and that cipher, he sent in another letter, which was his longest yet. It was actually 7 pages long. Since it was 7 pages, I'm not actually going to read you the whole thing. Again, there's going to be links to it on my website, but I will tell you the highlights, and I'm just going to list them off as they go, just to save us some time. He said things like, "The police shall never catch me because I have been too clever for them." He also wrote, "I look like the description passed out only when I do my thing." And then he said, "As of yet, I have left no fingerprints behind me, contrary to what the police say. In my killings, I wear transparent fingertip guards. All it is 2 coats of airplane cement coated on my fingertips. Quite unnoticeable and very effective." He ended the letter with, "P.S. 2 cops pulled a goof about 3 minutes after I left the cab. I was walking down the hill to the park when this cop pulled up, and one of them called me over. They asked if I saw anyone acting suspicious or strange in the last 5 to 10 minutes. I said yes, that there was a man who was running around waving a gun. And the cops peeled rubber and went around the corner as I directed them. I disappeared into the park, a block and a half away, never to be seen again." The letter also contained ingredients for a bomb that he had made, and there was also a diagram of where he put the bomb and how police could find it. He also warned them not to call him on his bluff. But I think you know how that went. On March 22, 1970, a young woman named Kathleen Johns, who was 22 years old, was driving with her 10-month-old daughter on Highway 132 near Modesto. A passing driver flashed his lights at her, and she thought that something was wrong, so she pulled the car over. He turned around and pulled up behind her. He got out of his car, went up to her window, and said that her back tire was wobbling, and offered to tighten the lug nuts for her. After he made an attempt to tighten the lug nuts, he went to the window and said that he couldn't fix it, and instead he'd offer her a ride to the closest gas station so that way she can call for a tow truck or for help. Obviously feeling very grateful, kind of suspicious, but more grateful than anything, she accepted his offer and off they went. Now this is where she started getting more suspicious. As they continued driving, they would pass gas stations and pass more and more gas stations, and he wouldn't even slow down. And she would say, "Oh, well, that was a gas station," or "Here's one coming up." And he would say, "Oh, that one's closed," or "Oh, that one doesn't have a phone that works," or whatever his excuse was. So at this point, she's like, okay, something's wrong. Something's up with this guy. He's super suspicious. Something's up. I'm out of here. So when they were stopped at an intersection, she took her baby and she jumped out of the car and ran away. A passerby saw her, picked her up, and took her to a police station. While she was at the police station, she was able to give a description of the man who kidnapped her, and after hearing this description, police showed her the wanted poster for the Zodiac, and she said that's who kidnapped her. A few weeks after her kidnapping, the Zodiac ended up sending a letter taking credit for her kidnapping, and even though he sent the letter, police never officially said that it was from the Zodiac. When the Zodiac stopped killing, he began to send more and more and more letters. There were so many that I had to cut out a lot of them. So I'm just going to breeze through this section just so you get an idea of what's going on. On April 22nd, 1970, he sent the Chronicle a letter saying that he killed 10 more people. On April 28th, 1970, he sent a greeting card to the Chronicle, demanding to have his bomb threats published, and said that he wanted the people of San Francisco to wear his signature crosshairs on a button. In July 24th, 1970, he sent another letter saying that he wasn't happy that people weren't wearing his button. And on October 5th, 1970, the Chronicle got another postcard from the Zodiac with 13 holes punched into it. And on this postcard, he claims that he's killed 13 people. At first, the police didn't think that this was the Zodiac killer sending the letter, but after further examination, they were able to determine that it was him. On October 27th, 1970, he sent Paul Avery, he was a writer at the San Francisco Chronicle, a Halloween card. Now, there was nothing too menacing in it. There was just a little, you know, a little blurb, a little... Actually, the writing that was on the card that he didn't even write was pretty interesting, and it was kind of crazy how it applied to the whole Zodiac situation. Again, it's linked on my website in the sources section. Check it out. Super interesting. On March 13th, 1971, he sent another letter, and in it, he basically claimed responsibility for the murder of Sherry Bates on October 30th, 1966. And after this letter, there wasn't a lot of communication received from the Zodiac until January 1973. And between January 1973 and December 1990, there was quite a few more letters that had been received by the Zodiac. But again, there were so many, I'm not going to put you through it. One of the websites that I have linked has information on all of it. You just have to click on each link on the website. In 1986, the Chronicle's cartoonist Robert Graysmith wrote a book called The Zodiac. I'm going to link this book. It's my Amazon affiliate link on my website. You can check it out for yourself. People consider this book to contain an extremely accurate history of the Zodiac and his crimes. So if you want to get all of the information pretty much straight from the source, you'd want to check out this book. He also wrote a second book that I'll link to, and it was called Zodiac Unmasked in 2002. In it, with confidence, he claimed that the now deceased, convicted child molester, Arthur Lee Allen from Vallejo, is the Zodiac killer. And interestingly enough, police still consider Arthur to be a suspect to this day. Eventually, the Zodiac stopped writing letters completely, and nobody knows why. It's one of the many questions surrounding this case. In and around October 15th-ish, 2002, San Francisco homicide inspectors were working with some DNA evidence, and they believed that they could possibly clear the suspect, Arthur Lee Allen. But due to some insufficient testing, the results were later determined to be inconclusive, so they couldn't rule out Arthur after all. Many people expressed their ideas on who the killer was. Some people would say, oh, it's my father-in-law, oh, it's my dad, oh, it's my brother, oh, it's this, it's my neighbor, it's John. There were a lot of people saying they knew who the killer was. In fact, there was a book written by a guy, I think his name was Gary Smith or Gary. I know his first name is Gary, but the book was called The Most Dangerous Animal of All. I read this book when it first came out. I think I was like in my early 20s. And I thought, oh my God, this guy, he figured it out. His dad is the Zodiac. But when I was doing research for this episode, I thought to myself, self, read the book again. There's a lot of information in there that you can include. And then I thought, well, I only have a week, so I'm not going to do that. I'm going to see if they made it a movie, because they make everything into movies. Luckily, yes, it wasn't turned into a movie. It was turned into a four-part series. I actually had to rent it from Apple TV to be able to watch it. It was aired on the FX channel, so if you live in the States, you can just Google the name of the show, and then go to the FX website and watch it. I don't think you have to pay for it, but because I'm in Canada, we don't have access to it, which is super annoying. But I digress. In this four-part series, I don't want to spoil it for you, but basically, they debunk all of this man's claims, all of Gary's claims. And it was really disappointing because I thought, oh my God, this is great. He solved it. But no, he didn't solve it. And even though I just told you that they debunked his claims, it's still a really interesting watch just to see how he got to the evidence that he found and why he thought that it proved that his dad was the Zodiac killer, and then why that evidence isn't actually evidence to prove his claims, if that makes sense. You'll have to watch it, but it's really good. Okay, so now that I've gone off on this little tangent, let me get back to what I was saying. Everyone and their mother had an idea or an explanation as to who the Zodiac could have been. And the ones that had decent evidence to their claims or decent proof, the police did investigate. Not all of them, but the really good ones. They investigated, and ultimately, no one was right. They still don't know who the killer was. Police still suspect Arthur Lee Allen. He is the number one suspect, but we'll never know. I don't want to say we'll never know, but Arthur Lee Allen is still ultimately their only suspect. In March of 2007, Hollywood's rendition of The Zodiac Killings aired, and it was called The Zodiac. It starred Jake Gyllenhaal, Robert Downey Jr., and a few other big-name actors. And then on May 4th, 2018, the Golden State Killer was actually caught with genealogical DNA searches, and the Vallejo Police Department heard about this and thought, hey, let's send off our DNA evidence and see if we can confirm who the killer was. So they did just that. They sent it out to a forensics lab, hoping to get this genetic profile to finally find the identity, and nothing came out of it. We never heard the results, so we're assuming they still haven't figured out who it is. Here's where we get to the juicy, juicy details that just aired this week. Well, I say this week, but it's really last week. But you know what I mean. On December 11th, 2020, the Z340 cipher was solved after 51 years and 1 month. People, can you imagine what it feels like to be the person, or persons, in this case there was three people, to solve a cipher that people have been trying to decipher for 51 years and 1 month? It's insane. It's crazy. We are living in historic times, people. It is awesome. So that little whatever that was aside, I'm going to link the YouTube video from one of the people who deciphered the cipher on my website. And in it, they explain how they did it, what brought them to each step, and ultimately the discovery. So without further ado, I'm going to read what the actual cipher said. Sit back, relax. This is history right here. You're hearing history. Here we go. I hope you are having lots of fun and trying to catch me. That wasn't me on the TV show, which brings up a point about me. I'm not afraid of the gas chamber because it will send me to paradise all the sooner, because I now have enough slaves to work for me where everyone else has nothing when they reach paradise. So they are afraid of death. I'm not afraid because I know that my new life is life will be an easy one in paradise death. Now, that cipher was 73 characters. I believe that there was some characters that are still, well, they were deciphered, but they just don't make sense. They're all mumbo jumbo, I guess. But the ending, as you notice, was probably a little confusing. So the likely intended message of that last part is, I'm not afraid because I know that my new life will be an easy one in paradise. Death is life. Like I said, this is amazing. This is such an incredible breakthrough. 51 years and 1 month. That's crazy. It took so, this man, that just proves my theory. He has so many spelling and grammatical mistakes or errors or whatever in his letter that if he can write something this complicated that takes 51 years and 1 month to solve, how can he not write proper English? Anybody who's out there who deciphers things for a living, not for a living, well, maybe for a living, or just for fun, let me know what you think. Is that, am I onto something, or am I just wrong? But while I was getting information for this case, I dove down into the deepest rabbit hole of information, and without sounding cheesy, I could have gotten lost in the information that was out there. There's one website where I got a lot of my information from, and with the information that I gathered, there's a lot, but there was so much more that I didn't tell you about, and it's just, The work people have put into this over the past how many years is so impressive. I've always had this respect for true crime writers and YouTubers and podcasters and all of those professions and more. And after doing the research for this episode, like I said, there was just so much. I got lost in the information. And the fact that these people are able to put forward such high quality content, y'all blow my mind. You guys, props to you. This is my second true crime podcast, I believe. And I hope to one day be at your level because, wow, bravo. I think that the Zodiac Killer and everything that he's done is the world's greatest mystery. There's so many unsolved, unanswered questions, and I think that we're always going to be finding answers, but also finding more questions. And I think the biggest question of all will most likely remain a mystery, and that's, who was the Zodiac Killer? Up until December 10th, 2020, I was convinced that we would never know anything more about this case because, well, we haven't found out any more about this case. But this recent discovery gives me hope that there will be, in my lifetime, an answer to hopefully that question. Who was the Zodiac Killer? Was it Arthur Allen? If it wasn't him, who was it? Other questions that I have are, what made him stop writing letters? Why did he start killing in the first place? Why did he stop? Were there any victims that we didn't know about? If so, how many? There's so many questions, I could keep going, but this episode is running a little long, so I'm gonna end it there. If you have answers to any of my questions or you have questions of yourself that you want to ask, go to thatcanadianpodcast.ca, find today's episode, and leave your thoughts and opinions and questions in the comment section. And if you haven't already, go to my website, and on the homepage, there's a picture of my husband and I with our nephew, Matthew, and there's a little blurb about him and his life, and there's a little donate button. And if you click the donate button, it'll bring you to the Canadian Cancer Society donation page. And I ask that for the month of December, all of my listeners go to the Canadian Cancer Society website or whatever cancer research society you have in your area and make a donation in memory of my nephew Matthew, or in memory or in honor of someone you know and love. If you want to know why, in the reincarnation podcast episode at the beginning, I explain why. And I believe in the blurb on the website, there's also a tiny explanation there as well. Either way, you should be able to find an explanation. And that wraps it up for today. So as always, thank you guys so much for listening to today's episode. This has been That Canadian Podcast. I am That Canadian. And stay safe out there.